Welcome to the special interview with We Are Libertarians. Joining me to my right is Greg Lenz, and across from us in the hot seat is Nick. Do you like Nick or Nicholas?
I'll go with Nick for today. That's
all right, Nick. Informal. Nick Sarwark. I wrongly called you Sarwak in previous episodes, and I'm very sorry.
I accept your apology, Chris.
All right. Good. I just made sure the recorder's rolling.
And what is your role with the LP?
Let me explain that joke. So we went to lunch yesterday, and Aaron Ewert, our friend, had lunch with Nick and Brett Bittner and I, and we were sitting there, and we'd been sitting there for like 45 minutes, and Aaron just kind of looks at Nick innocently, and he goes, "So, do you have like a position with the Libertarian Party?"
And I told him I was chair.
Right.
And then he asked, "Chair of what? Like the county?" And I said, "Just the party." And then he was a little taken aback, but then he became the newest National Party member from going out and having beers with the national chair. I guess apparently that's how you recruit people.
One beer at a time. So yes, Aaron joined the party and finally figured out, and then he immediately apologized for things that he had said about other Libertarian Party presidential candidates.
That's pretty much how it goes with Aaron Ewert. Is usually it's, let me show you this meme. And he has no idea that you are a person of influence, and then he offends you greatly, and then he apologizes.
But he doesn't feel bad about it. So, you know, we talked to Mark Rutherford, who's running for chair, and Nick came in for the Indiana Libertarian Convention. We are in the Wyndham lobby here and talking to Nick, and wanted to get his perspective on the National Libertarian Party serving as chair. So let's start out with where, you know, let's start with your background. Where did you come from, education, other biographical notes in your life?
Okay. So I've been a libertarian since I was 10, 11, 12, something like that. I would go to Maricopa County meetings in Phoenix with my father, who is a libertarian. So I'm a second generation libertarian. I've been involved with the Libertarian Party pretty much my entire adult life, 98 or 99. I got involved in Maryland. I became the state chair of the Maryland Party. After I moved to Colorado after law school to be a deputy public defender there, I was vice chair of the Colorado Party. I've served on lots of national committees, the Judicial Committee, the Bylaws Committee, and I've attended every national convention since Anaheim in 2000 when Harry Brown was nominated for the second time. And so I've been around the party for a long time, and I took it upon myself in 2014 that while the quality of decision making and the infighting on the LNC had gone down in the 2012 to 2014 term, it hadn't gotten good enough, and I felt like it was time to step up. If I wanted to do something better, I needed to put in the effort to do it, and so I ran for chair against Jeff Neal and won, and I've been in the job of the least important person in the Libertarian Party since the beginning of July of 2014.
Can you describe what the chair of the National Libertarian Party does exactly?
So there's a few different pieces of the job. Some of them are exciting and some of them are terribly boring. You run all of the national committee meetings. So you're the chair of the national committee. I believe we have 17 members now. And you maintain order and, you know, facilitate debate. One of the things I'm really proud of, and it's a weird thing to be proud of because not a lot of people notice, in past national committees, you have two-day meetings, Saturday, Sunday, and the committee meets. They would actually die with business still going for lack of a quorum because things would go so long that people would have to fly back home and you'd run out of committee members before all the business was done. In my term, we have never ended a meeting later than 2 o'clock on Sunday, ever, because people are, you know, expected to be on time. We abide by the time limits. People do their reports ahead of time. And it's just kind of the culture of respecting other people's time. It's a really little thing, but it's very different from how it used to be. So there's that. There's running the national convention. So next month in Orlando, I'll be managing a very large meeting of almost 1,000 people. And then they're serving as the official spokesperson for the party. So I take media requests. A couple weeks ago, I did interviews with the New York Times, the Washington Times, the Atlantic, NBC News, MSNBC, all about our presidential race. And so that's a role that I think is important. And it's a role that not all national chairs have wanted to do media. A lot of them have deferred that to the paid staff in Washington. But I think it's important for the chair to act as a spokesperson for the party.
Yeah, because people have an awareness of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. They have an awareness of Reince Priebus, who are your counterparts in the two, what you refer to as the old parties, which Sam Goldstein is very proud. That's like the one messaging thing that Sam Goldstein has. He was like, no, you call them the old parties. So,
They're old. This is a fact. They're old. They've been around longer than us. And if you look at their membership, they're old.
Yeah. Absolutely. So how much do you travel? I mean, because in my mind, like the national chair, their job is, you talk to the staff a little bit, kind of set direction. You deal with, the business end of the party. And then you fly around the country to meet libertarians everywhere. I mean, is that an accurate picture in my mind? I mean, is there a lot of travel and meeting members and all that kind of stuff?
There is. I made it a point when I became chair that I will basically go and speak at any state party convention where they invite me, assuming that family and business commitments allow me to travel. So I think in 2015, I logged about 50,000 miles flying around the country to speak to libertarians, to kind of help build them up and build up the state affiliates. And I think that's important. I think it's important that we recognize our members. You know, the least important person in the party thing is a line from my speech in Columbus. There is no national party without state parties. It's the state affiliates. It's the state chairs. It's the activists who go out to fairs and gun shows. It's the people who step up to run for office that really matter in this party. You have to have a national spokesperson and a national chair, but there is no national chair. There is no national committee without everybody else in the trenches doing the work. So I feel like it's very important, if you're going to be the chair, to go out and recognize those people and try and build them up and give them encouragement, give them thanks. One of the things I'm really proud of that we did that I don't know if it's been done in the past, but after the 2014 elections, I asked the staff to get names and addresses for every candidate we could find around the country. And I sent them all a thank you letter, just thanking them for stepping up to run for office, to wear the libertarian label, to give people that voice. And that isn't something that we had done in the past. And I think it's really important to thank these people who take time out of their lives to give people a libertarian option.
Yeah, and I do want to say that you are clearly tired and you're kind of starting to lose your voice a little bit. So if that comes across, that's what's happening. Here comes Greg Lenz with his first question.
No, it's interesting. When I hear you describe your role, I hear one of the things of being an effective manager is making the jobs of the people that are in the state parties, and anytime they're not an employee necessarily, but it's making them more effective. What can you do to make their job easier? And that's what I hear you talk about, in that how can I build them up, show them that they're rewarded and appreciated for their efforts, and what can I do to make everything easier for them? And that's sort of a role of management, I guess, in the private industry. Whereas what part of your position is also more leadership, where it's setting the right tone and then the right perception of Libertarian Party, but also the vision forward? What's the blend between management and leadership?
So from management side, I try and delegate effectively. So the people on staff who have responsibility to do things, I try and get the obstacles out of their way, give them the goal, and then do whatever I can to facilitate. I don't like to micromanage people. I do like, one of the things that I feel very strongly about, and not every chair has felt this way, is if there's something that happens at the national office that's not good, right? Something got done wrong. There have been previous chairs who have been willing to point the finger and say, well, that's, the executive director or somebody at national, they screwed up. I don't think that that's the right way to be. I think it's very important to build morale in the national office that the chair steps up and says, I take responsibility for it. And then if you have to have a private discussion with a staff member, then you have a private discussion. But you should take all the blame and you should give other people all the credit. And that's just my philosophy in my own business. As far as, the leadership side of it, it is setting the tone. I can't, we're libertarians, right? Libertarians don't agree on anything, and that's good. But we can set a tone where you show people how to go out and be nice to each other. You show people how to welcome people into the party instead of trying to find the one thing that they don't agree with us on and then beat that into their head until they're perfect. Because not a lot of people will stay around for that. And that culture change, I think, is happening. I think that we have a lot less infighting in the party than we used to. I think that things are moving a lot more smoothly in a positive direction. And it's going to be nice because once we have the presidential nominee in at the end of May, a lot of the focus comes off of me and goes on the presidential candidate. And then after the election's over, I think that these next 2 years going into 2018, the convention in New Orleans, it's going to be about building off of that momentum, building off of the success of this election cycle, going back and fighting some of those ballot access fights in places like Ohio, where they cheated to kick us off the ballot, you know, kind of going back and shoring up the state parties and really building a strong 50 state party. You know, that 50 state strategy is one of the few good things that Howard Dean did when he was chair of the Democratic National Committee, is this idea that we contest everywhere. Even the places where we're not strong will be stronger. We don't write off states. We don't write off races. We, you know, it's like a bad hockey team. They don't win every game, but they show up for all of them.
Let me follow up on that before, because I want to ask about ballot access, because this is a huge issue inside the Libertarian National Committee. On the one hand, I do see the argument of somebody like Bill Redpath, who has been a champion of ballot access for a very long time, and maintains that it's the lifeblood and the main duty of the party, that it is our job to make sure that we have ballot access in many states. But at the same time, you look at something like Oklahoma, where, you know, I've heard that the people in Oklahoma, they promised certain things, they didn't follow through on some of it, and then we spent, you know, near or over $200,000, you can correct me on that if you'd like, trying to get them on the ballot, and it's very, very difficult, and we have to do it every 4 years, or every two, I'm not sure how our strategy works. When we could take that money and put it into healthier states, a state like Indiana, a state like California, a state like Texas, that have active state parties, and we'll do something with the ballot access, and put that money into candidates, and put it into winning elections, because that is the way to grow our credibility. Where do you come down on either side of that argument? Obviously, there's, you know, one, there's always extremes. What is your analysis of that particular conundrum in terms of where do we place party funds?
Well, I think the basic assumption that you're making is the first place to start, because you're assuming that it's a static pie, that there's a static pool of money and there's only this much money and we can either help active parties or we can get ballot access in states where we don't have it. That's not the case. That's just not true. We spent a total of $105,000 getting the Libertarian Party of Oklahoma on the ballot and recognized as a political party by the state of Oklahoma for the first time since the year 2000. It's been 16 years since a libertarian in Oklahoma could be recognized as a libertarian by their government. And when we went out there for the press conference, when we turned in the signatures of over 42,000 Oklahomans who wanted a political choice, we had an event afterwards and we talked to people who had been in Oklahoma for those whole 16 years. And there were people who were getting tears in their eyes at the idea that now, finally, they were going to be able to be who they were. They were going to have the right that you have in Indiana to register as a libertarian, the right that I have in Arizona to register as a libertarian. And the goal is not 50 state ballot access. The goal is that every single American who wants a libertarian option can vote for a libertarian option. The goal is to go out there and make sure everybody gets to vote libertarian. That requires 50 state ballot access, but it's not, the goal isn't just we want to knock off these states. The goal is that what we want is to give people that option, and it makes us stronger. And if there is one thing that the national party can do that state parties can't do, It's to marshal those funds, to marshal those resources, and go to these states that need help. Go to these states where the government is extra bad. And government's not always a little bad, but I mean, we're talking really cheaty, cheaty bad. And go there and bring the fight to them and tell them, look, we're not going to roll over for this. We're not going to put up with this. You know, Oklahoma is a long story, but the short version is they've been going to try and reduce ballot access requirements there for 20 years, and they keep getting spiked by the legislature. So when they passed a bill out, the majority leader carried a bill, the bill passed out that reduced the requirement, not as much as we wanted. The National Party actually stepped up to hire a lobbyist to make sure that it didn't get spiked in conference and actually went to the governor's desk and got signed. And then Richard Winger from California pledged $30,000 for Oklahoma ballot access. That's not money that I get to use for another state. It's a pledge that's contingent on matching funds. And I got on the phone and I started calling people, and we raised, you know, myself, Bill Redpath, we raised $30,000 to match it. So we had $60,000 in seed money for that. And yeah, the costs went over. And yeah, if your party's been basically crushed by the state for decades, the Oklahoma party isn't as strong as we'd like it to be. But they nominated 17 candidates for public office for a party that just has only been legal in the state of Oklahoma for a couple weeks. And they're on fire there. I mean, they have a strong candidate for governor, or not governor, it's Senate, I think. Really, really great candidates. They've got really great activists. And that energy and that success from Oklahoma, getting Oklahoma is the only reason that we can have 50 state ballot access. We still need to raise a couple hundred thousand dollars, but it's a possibility. If we didn't get Oklahoma last year, it's not possible. And that's what we have to do, is do the groundwork to put ourselves in a position to succeed and then use that success to build into more success. That fundraising goes up after a success like Oklahoma, even though it costs a lot of money. But it's a big risk, and you know, we'll see how people feel about it.
Sort of sounds like, too, it sets a precedent that the Libertarian Party isn't going away to other state legislatures. Like, this one fight sets the tone for every single one from here on in.
Right, and that's the same reason, you know, that basically tells Ohio that after this election, we're going to be back there to deal with their shenanigans. We sued Kentucky Educational Television because they excluded our senatorial candidate from the debate with Mitch McConnell in it, and that lawsuit's still pending because we're not going to roll over when our candidates get challenged. You know, when you had a candidate here in Indiana who had a recount, she lost by 6 votes in a local election. I myself gave $50 to the recount effort, not because I necessarily thought the election would change, but because that's what we have to do. We have to stand behind our candidates. If they're going to go out and take the time to stand for you, then you have to stand behind them. You have to follow up with them. You know, we backed Gigi Bowman in New York when the Republicans tried to challenge her off the ballot. We funded a lawsuit, or funded her legal defense. My goal is to have the Libertarian Party be more supportive of libertarians. If you're willing to go out there and fight for me, I'm willing to go out there and fight for you. I'm willing to back you up. And I want it to be clear to our donors, because one of the things that keeps donors on the sidelines is if you get a bunch of money for a ballot access drive and you fail, you've just thrown their money in a hole and set it on fire. That kills donors. I treat donors' money more carefully than I treat my own money. I waste a lot of my own money. Donors' money is sacrosanct. But we show them a history of success, and then they want to come back and help us do more things. You know, we show them return on investment. And you look at an election where Republican donors have burned $160-some million on trying to get Jeb Bush the nomination. When you can give the Libertarian Party a few hundred thousand dollars and we can have a libertarian voice on the ballot in every single state, I mean, if you're in business, the ROI on that is way better than like backing Jeb Bush for some half a loaf, you know, mealy mouth discussion of libertarian ideas that he's just going to walk away from as soon as he gets in power.
With the terms only being 2 years, how is it, and I'm sorry, not familiar with like the past history of the Libertarian Party, but isn't like with a vision like you have, isn't there that danger where you start to have a little success, but then it makes you politically vulnerable, and so someone seizes on that and changes the initiative to another, you know, another direction, and it's sort of like a seesaw of stops and starts. How do you combat that?
I mean, here's the thing. I have three announced competitors for my job: Mark Rutherford, Brett Pajunas, and a gentleman named Charles Perallo. And they're going to go to Orlando and they're going to give a case for why they should be the chair starting at the end of that convention. Personally, even though it's a hard job and it's a volunteer job, I don't think it's responsible to step down as chair going into an election. I think that transition time would lose us momentum in a year when we really need to keep up the momentum. But that's a case I have to make to the delegates. You know, they have to look at the record coming out of Columbus in 2014 to now, what has been successful, what hasn't been successful, what the vision is going forward, you know, and you have to make that case. Until we, you know, if we shift to four-year terms where you have national leadership elected in off years, then we wouldn't have that transition problem. But as long as our bylaws are what they are, those are the rules I have to play in.
And just one follow-up. In your experience so far, since you were elected in 2014 and then now going to 2016, seeking that term, with your vision for the party, have you encountered something where it butts heads with candidates? Because I would imagine sometimes candidates get to dictate the vision during a political cycle more so than you as executive director. Has there been a circumstance where there has been something where they have an idea and path they want to take the party as a candidate and you don't necessarily agree and have had to either get on board or be an outspoken critic of where they want to take the party?
So my position as chair is neutral as to candidates. I don't endorse candidates for the presidential nomination. It's not prohibited. I just don't think it's the proper role. As chair, I will work to support whoever the candidates are and back them as much as I can. Every one of the presidential candidates that is running now, there are issues that I personally disagree with them on. There are things that they say that I wouldn't say or that I wouldn't say in that way. But that's not my choice. That's the delegate's choice. And the role that I have as chair is to support them. The difference with the Libertarian Party is we have a pretty good platform, and that platform says what the party stands for. And so the presidential race, the presidential candidate will have the issues that they want to run on, but it's not something where the party adopts the president's vision. No matter how good or bad a Libertarian candidate for president is, their campaign basically lasts 6 months from the convention to the first week in November. The party is forever. The party keeps going. The party has to keep going through that time between election cycles. And it's important to make sure that we have a clearly articulated platform, clearly articulated principles, and somebody who's able to give those principles to the American people in between elections.
What have been the biggest challenges that you have faced in your time as the national chairman?
The biggest challenge of this job, and if you ever read Drucker on managing the nonprofit corporation, which I recommend for anyone who's involved in the party, is that the board of the Libertarian Party is not like the board of a corporation. The CEO doesn't pick the board members because they agree with his or her vision. The delegates at convention and the various states pick the board members for the national committee, and they come from very different perspectives. And there are people on the national committee who I have not agreed on a policy, an internal Libertarian Party policy matter, for well over a decade. Not a single one. But we still work together effectively. And so the biggest challenge has been to facilitate the voices of people who strongly disagree with you, because that actually brings us closer together. As chair, I've learned that embracing and bringing out everybody's viewpoints actually makes you a stronger chair than trying to use the power of the chair to get your own agenda. If you don't try and fight all the fights, you're better able to win the ones that you do decide to actually fight for. It's picking your battles. It's just like being a parent or anything else. But a lot of that was from observing previous chairs and what they've done and what has worked for them and what hasn't. So I don't think, you know, the job is kind of what I expected it to be. It's really hard. Libertarians will tell you their opinions on everything you do. They're big on sharing that with you. And, you know, I try and listen to everybody. I try and hear everyone out. I try and respond to everybody, you know, and I try to be accessible so that if there's something you think I should be doing differently, you at least feel like I've heard you. You've told me what you think your vision is. You've had a chance to clearly articulate it. And if we go a different direction, it's not because I'm not listening. It's because, you know, that's the job. You have to make choices.
To be quite frank, I've kind of felt that the National Libertarian Committee is a waste of time. I mean, as a person who was an executive director and then was out, you know, has been in the wilderness because of personal issues, I just didn't see a lot of direct benefit to the Libertarian Party of Indiana and to our candidates and to our volunteers when I was executive director. And it seemed like the National Libertarian Committee was more mired in policy manual debates about how the staff would be controlled than winning elections. How have you managed that culture? Does that culture still remain? I mean, it's always going to be there to some extent because people are going to have... it's just the nature of libertarians. They're so INTJ that they're very focused on the process without seeing the forest that lays ahead. What would you say to somebody like me who has been a party leader that just doesn't see a lot of benefit of the National Libertarian Committee?
Well, the first thing I'd say is things have changed. Things have changed. One of the things that we did, this convention was very well attended. I think we had 120 people in the room. The Libertarian Party of Minnesota convention last weekend had 170 people in the room. Part of the reason that the Minnesota Party is such a powerhouse is their executive director, Andy Burns, was just incredible at organizing, at fundraising, at branding, at messaging, at really getting people fired up, which is why we did some targeted fundraising to have an affiliate support specialist, a person who works for the national party, whose only job is to go and help state parties become bigger and better, get better at fundraising, at messaging, at branding, get to the point where they can hire executive directors. So we poached the executive director of Minnesota, and Andy Burns now works for the national party, going to various states like California and Washington and helping them build themselves back up. And a lot of this was based, honestly, on my experience in Colorado when Evan McMahon had come down as part of his job with the Libertarian National Campaign Committee and helped build up the Colorado Party and help give us organizational advice. And a lot of the friction in the Libertarian Party for decades, and I had been guilty of it as a state chair myself in Maryland, is National was seen as sort of a giant money pit. And it was seen as this static pie. You either give your money to National or you give it to your state, but there's only so much money. What I wanted to do was really, I can say that the National Party doesn't exist without the states, but actually focusing somebody who's dedicated full time to helping the state parties is a way of showing it. And showing it is always better than saying it. I judge people based on what they do, not based on what they say. I can give a good speech, but when you actually have somebody going from state to state to help people, and we fundraise directly to fill that position, I think it sends a better message about what the National Party can do. There are still people on the committee who are very concerned with what I would consider to be arcane details of the policy manual or audits or things that just take up a lot of time and don't move the ball down the field. And I make sure that we address those issues. But if the body isn't interested in being concerned in it, then we move quickly through that and we move back to our goals. This LNC actually has goals for a number of candidates that we want to run nationwide, for the number of states we want to get ballot access on. We have set goals for the party. One of the things that's very difficult and is a challenge is none of the goals are related to either dues-paying membership numbers or revenue targets. So we focus on the external politics. The last 2 years has been focused on running candidates for public office, on the being a political party. And it's been difficult to keep the party in the black because, you know, you can either be writing fundraising letters or you can be trying to build up and recruit candidates. And I have to give a lot of props to Wes Benedict because he manages to do both. We were in the black in 2015. Revenue and membership numbers are on uptick the last 2 or 3 months. And I think that they'll keep rising because I don't think that revenue or membership numbers, I don't think that's a leading metric. I think it's a lagging indicator that if you're successful in the political realm, if you're getting more voter registration numbers, if you show people success, that's when the revenue and the membership follow. It's not the other way around.
And that's such a key point. And that is where I felt past LNCs and chairman. And to be quite frank, I haven't followed your time closely, so I can't make a judgment on this. All I can do is ask questions and learn. We have been obsessed with membership at the national and the local level. And it doesn't make any sense to me because we're not a club. We're a political party trying to win elections. And yes, membership is important for fundraising reasons, but membership is not, it shouldn't be the leading metric that our national staff and our national body, our national committee and chairman are judged by. It should be by the strength and the growth of the political functions of the party. How many voter registrations? Are we winning offices? Are we? And one of the problems that I experienced when I was executive director was just the lack of big data. You know, this really hit home in Iowa when Hillary Clinton was moving people with, they've built their platform in Hillary's campaign around a sales database. They're approaching it like a sales problem. And in Iowa, they assigned one volunteer to one person. It was one-to-one in Iowa. And that person was shepherding that person, calling them 20 or 30 times, showing up at the caucuses to make sure that they show up and vote. In November, they're going to be able to have that same person contact that same person, theoretically. And it takes a tremendous, I don't think people realize, like, that sounds very simple. Like, yeah, that's a great idea. Everybody should do that. But I don't think people have any kind of concept as to how much capital, in terms of human and monetary, that it takes to set up a system like that. You've got to have the data. You've got to have the lead generation. You've got to have the people to execute that effectively. Our national party uses something called Razor's Edge, which, if you are a major institution and you have a bunch of people working on Razor's Edge, it works well. But we haven't, and again, I've been gone for 2 years, so correct me if I'm wrong, but there hasn't been a lot of two-way communication. You know, I was getting spreadsheets in Excel in 2012, and I was never sending information back up to the national party. I did my best. I said, hey, if you're going to sign up to be a candidate, go through the national party. If you're going to do this, go through the national website. But it just doesn't, there wasn't something like Voter Vault, which I used when I was in the Republican Party at one point. Voter Vault was a two-way system, segmented. It was a very useful database in both fundraising and voter grassroots efforts, which those are the two things that we ought to be using data-wise. Membership is just a function for the convention, you know, and to raise money and to identify supporters. But it isn't what is going to win elections. So how do we as the Libertarian Party close the gap on big data?
One of the things that Razor's Edge is good for, it's good for tracking donors. It's a nonprofit fundraising management. It's like a CRM for a nonprofit. But it is not by nature political. It's the political thing would be a bolt-on. It's not what it's designed to do. One of the things that the ITG committee looked at this term was the potential for the national party to move over to Nation Builder and then have subnations of the various state parties as a way of both reducing the cost as well as having some data interchange and some real power to identify voters and identify supporters like that. And right now it was just too much money and frankly, the committee wasn't ready to pull the trigger. I mean, we had a proposal on the table. We had a dollar figure. I probably could have worked on raising the money to support the dollar figure, but the committee's ready for what they're ready for when they're ready for it. We're trying to make it better. We're in the midst of a redesign of the national website. We have a very prestigious firm out of Texas. I don't want to identify any more than that just because they want to keep... We're a political party, so there's baggage associated with working for us. But they're working on a redesign now. We'll probably have some presentation of it at the convention, although I don't think launch is going to be until later in the summer. But we want to do things like have a better mobile presence and get better at that funnel, that capture of from an interested person who just saw the website to, you know, $5 donor who gives us a little bit of cash to support something, to a member, to a pledger, to, you know, a life member like me. You know, we want to create that funnel and that pipeline because it's good for the long-term growth of the party. Part of the problem we have with trying to go to a voter vault kind of model is we're not big enough yet. We can't do one-to-one. We can probably not even do 1 to 10. And that's why one of the things I've been focusing a lot on is let's do the basic work of in those states where you can run for office as a libertarian without a really onerous requirement, let's fill the whole ballot. Let's get to the point where we're running a libertarian for every single contested partisan office across this country. And then that will help bring people in. People get excited by campaigns in a way that they never get excited by the national office. They get excited about a candidate. They get excited about a person who's trying to make their community better. And then some of them stay around and become activists and get interested in what the state party's doing. That's the way you bring people in. And if you look at the political metrics, the good news I have for you is we're the only political party in the country that's growing in partisan voter registration. The only one. The Democrats are shrinking. The Republicans are shrinking. The Greens are shrinking. Constitution Party shrinking. Only the Libertarians are growing right now. We have a powerful message that we want to support your right to live your life any way you choose, as long as you don't hurt anybody and you don't take their stuff. And that resonates in a way with people that, you know, the old parties just can't compete with. And we just have to keep bringing that message out there and helping people along that path to becoming libertarian. Because I don't look at people as libertarians and not libertarians. I look at people as libertarians and people who are not libertarian yet.
One thing I think is that I find interesting about your philosophy is that you're part of what you're known for is your defense of NOTA, which basically means that, you know, for those unfamiliar, there might be two candidates pursuing, you know, the position, and you are famous for your defense of not nominating anyone. But then you're also in a position of growing the party, which would seem, it seems counterintuitive to me about being inclusive and then being in support of NOTA. But you make a good defense of it. And I think, you know, I think it's something that more people need to hear. And I just wanted to ask you about that and how you reconcile the two.
And let me get my pound of flesh on this, Nicholas. So Mark Rutherford, who we've had on the podcast a couple times, we've interviewed Mark, so you can go back and hear the opposition here. Mark was running for chair in 2012 in Las Vegas, and he ended up losing by one vote to NOTA, as spoken for and introduced by one Nicholas Sarwark. I wasn't happy, but I wasn't like mad at you, but it was just, so it's become an inside joke the last 4 years, and there was one guy who was going to run for our third district here, and I was just like, hey Nick, can I borrow that NOTA speech? But, explain yourself.
All right, so I'll explain myself. First of all, for anyone who wants to see the speech, it's on YouTube. If you go Google Sarwark, and Nota, N-O-T-A, for none of the above, you can find the speech. It's only 2.5 minutes long. I didn't take a long time. What was happening coming into... They're rolling tables behind me because, see, this is how you get rid of the Nota argument. I'm being muzzled by the establishment. What happened coming into the 2012 nomination was there was some things that happened during the LNC term from 2010 to 2012. There was some serious infighting and behavior on that national committee that I felt like was a culture that we didn't want to continue. And both people who were running for chair was Mark Hinkle, the existing chair, who had been the leader of the party during this culture, and Mark Rutherford, the vice chair, who had been the second in command during this culture. And both of them had participated in this behavior, which I didn't think was healthy for the party. And so what I stood up on the floor of the convention in Vegas and said was, none of the above is always an option in the Libertarian Party. Libertarian candidates are fundamentally, structurally better than the old party candidates because we don't have to only be better than the other people running. We have to be better than nobody. And there are a lot of old party candidates who get nominated and elected to Congress who are not better than nobody. And in the Libertarian Party for internal office, if none of the above wins, if we don't like the candidates, we get better candidates. You can stand up and say, you know what? Not those guys. And then we ended up with Jeff Neal got nominated in the subsequent nomination and was the chair from 2012 until 2014 when I ran against him. And honestly, I've told you this privately. When I gave that speech, I didn't expect that it would get more than maybe 15%, that it would send a message, kind of like a lot of people run as a libertarian. You're going to send a message to the old parties, but you don't think you're going to win the office. And it was a surprise that the way the delegates broke, you know, just the discord between the factions that each Mark represented, the second choice of one Mark wasn't the other Mark. It was not him either. And that things break kind of weird in our internal elections. And we've talked about this in the presidential nominating. It's not so much who you support necessarily. It's also after that person gets eliminated on a ballot, where do their supporters go next? Where did the votes fall out? And in Vegas, it ended up that the votes for Hinkle after Hinkle was eliminated went to Nota instead of Rutherford. And it surprised me as much as it surprised everyone else. But I think it was healthy. It was the first time that none of the above has ever won, to my knowledge, in National Party history since 1971. So it was pretty cool. You know, I don't give Nota speeches at every convention. It's not always necessary. It's a thing you use when it's needed.
And to clarify then, is it just for internal elections or do you stand by that for even public filling candidate spots?
I stand by it for filling candidate spots as well. It's just the rules work a little differently. For anyone who's coming to Orlando, if none of the above wins for the presidential nomination, the party will not have a nominee. The National Party will not have a nominee. State parties might do something, but the National Party will not have a presidential nominee. For internal elections, you reopen nominations, but the people who were beaten by none of the above are not allowed to be the nominee. I do support it for external elections, too. I think that if you can go into a convention of libertarians, like here in Indiana, and you can't get more of them to like you than not you, then that's a good safety valve for us. Like, that person doesn't go out and be the face of the party. Let's say you have some virulent racist who wants to be a nominee for Congress and no one else will step up to run. None of the above lets us say, you know what, that's not us. We appreciate the fact that you're trying, but no. That's an amazingly powerful tool. I would love to have Nota in public elections all around the country. I think it would be great.
Well, as far as I have, that's all the questions. Chris, do you have anything?
So you have a three points, philosophical points, maybe. I don't know if they're platforms necessarily in what you're running on, but you touched on them at lunch today, and I'd like you to kind of touch on those again.
Yeah, so when I've been going around to state party conventions, and I haven't visited all of them yet, but I've visited a lot in the last 2 years, one of the speeches I give, the main speech I give to libertarian audiences, is I ask the members of state parties to do three things. I want them to show up, I want them to be nice, and I want them to win. You know, the showing up is that giving voice to the voiceless. You know, the idea, people often talk about the wasted vote is voting for someone you don't believe in. That's not really the wasted vote. The wasted vote is when we've actually convinced somebody that they are libertarian. They're done with the old parties. They're done with the lies. They're done with the corruption. They want to vote libertarian. They're not listening to these arguments that, you know, that's throwing away your vote. They're going to do it. And they get into the ballot box and there's not a libertarian on their ballot. We've just wasted a libertarian vote there. That's a vote that we didn't get because we didn't catch it. It's like rain coming down. It can either go out your gutter or you can put a rain barrel down and you can collect that. We can collect these votes. They're out there. The being nice, you know, libertarians just engage in a lot of infighting. We're all very sure we're right, and it's because we are, but we're so eager to tell other people it, and people don't like to hear that you're right and they're wrong. They like to know that they've been heard, and they like to engage in a dialogue. And so we need to be a lot more welcoming to people, even if they're not all the way along the path to perfect libertarian. If we're nice to them, then they'll continue along the path and they'll get better. Or they'll decide that this isn't for them and they'll leave, but they'll leave on good terms. They won't dislike libertarians. They'll just be like, you know, that wasn't for me. We need to do that to encourage more people into the party and to keep them. You know, we don't have money or special favors or political patronage to give out. We just have how good we are as people. And the winning is really, it's a twofold thing. We go out there and we contest every single election because there's two ways to look at the job of a libertarian candidate. You can look at the job of a libertarian candidate as you need to go out there and get the majority of the votes in your election, 50% plus one, or 33% plus one if it's a three-way race, and win that seat. And if you don't, you're a loser. You're a loser who loses. And the Stoic philosopher Epictetus likes to talk about how everything in life has two handles, that by which it can be born and that by which it can't. You have to pick things up by the right handle. If you listen to the old parties when they say you're a loser who loses, you're not going to run again. You're going to get depressed because that's what they want you to do. They want you to be discouraged because they don't like having us in the race calling them out on their terrible policies. They want to get us to quit before we even start. If you pick it up by the right handle, it's a lot easier. If you look at the Cleveland Browns, they were the worst team in the NFL. They won three games last year, but they played all 16. And every single one of those players, their job is to put on that goofy-looking Cleveland Browns uniform, go out on that field, and represent the hopes and dreams of every Cleveland fan, which may be dashed by the end of the season, sure, but they go out there and they show up for them every single game, whether they lost the last three games in a row or not. They keep going at it. They never quit. And remember, we talked about the old parties. They're old. We're not. And if we don't quit, we'll just outlast them. We'll just keep going, and then we will actually start taking the seats because we keep trying. We keep going out there, and we proudly put on the libertarian jersey, and we stand for the voiceless. We stand for the people who don't have a special interest lobby. They don't have a big bank. They don't have crony capitalists. They don't have unions. We stand for the people who want to raise their families, who want to run their businesses, who want to live their life the way they see fit without interfering in other people's lives, and that's all they want. Those people have no voice in American politics except the Libertarian Party. And so we win by going up and standing up for them. And that's something, you know, I do this. The reason I take time away from my three kids is for my three kids. I have three children, a 5-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 1-year-old. And I want them to grow up in a country that's freer than the one I grew up in. I want what our Statement of Principles talks about. We seek nothing less or more than a world set free in our lifetime. That's what we want. That's what we stand for. And it's a beautiful message, and more people are hearing it. We just have to keep going out there, putting on that jersey, being nice to everyone we meet, and bringing more people along that path.
So should you win another term, what would be your priorities going forward?
The immediate priority is obviously to launch the newly redesigned website, to continue with rolling out the new modern branding, to really, you know, put a much more professional image on the Libertarian Party than it's had. I mean, we've been in the need of a visual refresh for a while to support this presidential campaign and to work closely with the presidential campaign with a contract that means that the Libertarian Party will get bigger as a result of the presidential campaign. That hasn't been executed as well as it should be in the past. The last campaign that really brought in a lot of members was the Brown campaign. We need to get back to that, where the party ends up stronger at the end of the presidential race, regardless of who the nominee is. And then once we get past that race, once those thank you letters go out to every single one of these libertarians who went out there and stood up for their communities, that's when we start building up. That's where we start going out to some of these problem states like Ohio, where the government is so corrupt and John Kasich will cheat with both hands to kick us off the ballot, and we go fight them in the legislature. We go, you know, get the petition signatures to get party status again. We show them that if you beat us, we will come back harder every single time, and they will stop messing with us because they'll know that we mean it. We will stand up for our libertarians. That's what we're here for. And we build those relationships. We build the coalitions. In the Liberty Movement, this is no secret. In the Liberty Movement, there are a lot of people who consider the Libertarian Party to be a waste of time or fringe or, you know, let's just fix the Republican Party. The Libertarian Party is the only political manifestation of libertarianism. If you work within the Republican or Democratic parties, you will constantly be faced with backbiting and infighting from people who don't really want freedom. We're smaller, but everyone's pointed in the same direction. Everyone wants liberty. You're not always checking your neck to see who's coming out after you, like, you know, a Thomas Massie or Justin Amash has to do. You know, they're constantly fighting with their own leadership in addition with fighting with the other side. So we need to show people that if you really want liberty in the political realm, if you want to express your libertarianism in terms that politicians understand, because a lot of politicians are stupid and a lot of them are corrupt, but every single one of them can count, and they can count a libertarian vote, and they know that that means you're not playing their game anymore, but you're active enough that you're going to go out and vote for it. You know, no one can tell a principled non-voting anarchist from a dude who just got too high and wanted to play Xbox on a Tuesday. They look the same. But a libertarian vote sends a clear message that neither of the old parties will send. And when you control, you know, this 4%, 5%, 6%, some people call it spoiling and say you're going to lose. But if you live in an evenly divided district, you control the balance of power. You have more control over who gets that seat than either of the two old party candidates do. And we need to start taking our power as libertarians and going out there and shaping the debate and not being reactive and not buying into the rules they want us to buy into, that you're a losing loser who loses. No, I run this election. You guys are just players in it.
When I look at some of the powerhouse states from several years ago, like Texas, California, some of those states that were up and coming several years ago are sort of anemic right now, and there's not a lot of activity. I won't ask you what you think the state of the Libertarian Party is, because I'm just going to guess that it's strong. But so I will instead ask, why does that happen? And where are some of the pockets of strength that you see as you travel around the country? We have a national audience, so if you're in one of these states, jump in. And heck, if you're in one of the anemic or non-existent party states, start one, right?
Right. I mean, it ebbs and flows. The states that are strong end up not being strong, and the states that were weak end up being strong, and this kind of goes up and down, and has for the almost two decades I've been in the party. What happens is we burn out our best activists. We take the people that do all the work, and instead of like cultivating the next generation of leaders, we just throw everything on that person's shoulders until, you know, they end up divorced and alcoholic and they quit the party and they quit politics. And one of the quotes that I really like, and I use it in my speech, is good leaders create followers, but great leaders create new leaders. And one of the things that they've done in Washington State that appears to be really working for them, and that's one of the new powerhouses, is they turn over the state chair every single year. Every year. One of your jobs as chair, and I think it's been made explicit, one of your jobs as chair is to find the next chair, is to build somebody up, is to help people develop those skills, and then you go move on to help somewhere else. You go and move on to help your local party. You keep moving around, and you keep cross-training people, and you keep taking new activists and saying, give them responsibility, give them something to do, share that burden. It's harder to delegate than to do things yourself. Anyone who's ever been in management or owns a business knows this. I can do it better than any one of my employees can do it. But you work hard to let them take ownership of it, and that's how you grow. And so the states that are powerhouses are the ones where they do spread the labor around. They let people help. People want to help. They want you to give them something to do. And so we need to stop burdening our best activists and start encouraging them to train up new ones, encouraging people to, you know, shadow that guy. If that guy is really good at running a meeting, you know, what I like to do as national chair, in addition to the reason, you know, you got to take bathroom breaks and stuff, I like to hand the gavel off to my vice chair, Arvind Vora, so that he can get better at running a meeting, because the only way to do it is to do it. And it's a way to build him up. You know, it's a way to help him become better. I want everybody to be better in this party. And I want us to be happy warriors together and build each other up as much as we can. I mean, we fight about stuff. And at this state convention, there's some contested races. But it's important that when you're fighting over the party, you should fight hard because it's important. This is the most important political party in the country. But you want to make sure that whoever wins, what you have left is a party worth fighting for. And even if you don't win that race, even if your candidate doesn't win, even if somebody you think is not a good candidate gets a nomination, you know, either support them, or if you just can't bring yourself to support them, support somebody else. Find another candidate. Find something else to do to keep moving forward. Don't engage in the negativity or the internal attacks. Once people get the nomination, you know, find something positive to do. I don't know. I'm kind of preaching to the choir, I think, from, you know, listening to your guys. I think this isn't a philosophy that's too different, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is important to be passionate about the party. We may not always be polite, and we are out to win, but I think that's how politics works. I think there has to be a little bit of you just have to have passion for what you do. And sometimes, you know, anyways, people who listen to the podcast around the episode in which this appears will kind of hear how things have gone in this party. But, you know, I think it just comes down to the golden rule. I think the reason I'm a libertarian is that it perfectly fits within my belief of the golden rule, is you treat people how you'd like to be treated. And I would like the government to not control me, so I don't want the government to do that to other people. Final question, because I do think that this is something that a lot of people talk about, but maybe people don't quite understand. We are one of three national. We are one of three political parties that owns their own building. We lease a condominium, and this was a very contentious thing for a very long time. There are people like Jim Lark who, you know, I'm going to donate to this so we can have this. Where did you come down in the building debate? And this is super internal baseball, but for the delegates that might be listening, this is something that they probably care and want to know about. Because from a person who is not involved in the trenches of the LNC, it seems to me that, again, spending that money and that effort raising that money on buying a building in Alexandria, old Alexandria, where it's expensive property, is that the best use of our resources? What was the thinking behind that, and where did you come down on it?
Oh, boy. This is going to be a long answer. So, first of all, I was never a big supporter of the building. I didn't contribute directly to it. When it was being debated before I was on the LNC. That decision was made well before I was on it, and my regional rep didn't support it. One of the things that prompted me to run for chair, I was at a bylaws committee meeting that coincided with an LNC meeting. And after the decision to buy a building had been, or buy an office, I should say, because it's an attached building, buy an office. After that decision was made, after the contract was going to be signed, there were people on the committee who spent a good solid hour arguing over whether or not we should have looked at different properties after we had already decided on a property, after we were already moving out of the Watergate. They wanted to relitigate a decision that had already been made. After the decision had been made to buy the building or the office, I've been a huge cheerleader for it because this is a decision that the committee made. This is something that donors gave directed funds to do, and I support the decisions that the party makes, even if they're not the decision I think the party should make. That's the role of a chair. You don't let your personal feelings interfere with your duty to the party and to the membership. With the office, there's a couple of things. There's a permanence and a stability of having a mortgage payment versus having rent that can be raised. You know, you have a static number. The other thing is the monthly nut on our office is lower than we had at the Watergate. We actually save money in buying an office, and we're planning for the long term. We're a long-term party. That's one of the things that is so important for us to tell the doubters and the haters within the broader liberty movement is it's almost 45 years, 45 years in December. We haven't gone away, and we're not going anywhere. We don't buy an office because we're going anywhere. We're here to stay. If anything, you know, the only time we're going to sell that office is when we're buying a bigger office because we're a bigger damn party. That's, we're not leaving. And that stick-to-itiveness is something that's so necessary. When you talk about the parties that ebb and flow, the state parties that kind of go into a hole, in order to be respected as a political choice for voters who are considering us, we have to keep showing up election after election. They have to see that we're not going to go away, that this isn't a Ross Perot thing. I mean, he excited a bunch of people when he ran for president. But, you know, a candidate's just a candidate. He's not a party. The Libertarian Party will always be there for voters who want all of your freedoms all of the time. Always. We're not going anywhere.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, and people listening need to figure out, are you a party builder, a candidate, or a campaign manager? There are three distinct personalities. I've always been a party builder, Evan McMahon, who was mentioned earlier, campaign manager, the guy who's just going to live on coffee and nothing else and stay up till 4 a.m. and gets really excited for 9 months, but then needs, you know, time off. And then there's the candidate who, usually they're a little more self-involved than a party builder. This is shameless self-promotion time. This is the opportunity for you to say anything you want, anything that you want to plug. Where can people find more information on you and your race? And plug whatever you want.
So the first thing is join the Libertarian Party, lp.org/join. Become a member. Like, vote with your dollars. It's $25, but we prefer if you be a monthly pledger. But, you know, put your money where your mouth is. When it comes to libertarian, and whether you're a big L or a little L libertarian, size matters. Like, you know, it's time for us to come out of the closet. It's time for us to be loud and proud about our libertarianism. If people want to find out more about me, about where I stand, things like that, I have a Facebook page. It's Sarwark for Chair, the number 4. It's my LNC chair page. That's all my political stuff. You can follow my personal profile on Facebook. It's just Nicholas Sarwark. I'm the only one. I'm on Twitter, at N Sarwark. I'm on Instagram, at N Sarwark. I have a Snapchat that's N Sarwark, but I'm not very good at it yet. You know, and I mean, get involved. Get involved in your local party. Step up and run for office. You know, that's the best thing you can do. If you are going to be a delegate in convention in Orlando, if you're a libertarian, if you like what you've seen from me in the media, if you like how the culture of the party is changing, if you like what I'm doing, then please support me for re-election. Because if you like the direction we're going, the middle of an election year is not the time to change it.
All right. Well, thank you. And we'll put a link in the show notes. So if you go look at the description, you can click a link to your Facebook page. So thank you for joining us. We appreciate it. And, you know, have some luck. It depends on who you're voting for. I will not be in Orlando. I apologize. As Austin Peterson, as he walked away, he goes, "Oh, okay, so a race is more important than the future of our country." It's like, yeah, but you're not from Indiana. You're not from Indiana. You're not from Indianapolis. You don't understand the 100th running of the Indy 500. Like, it's Super Bowl times three. It is the future of the country. So thank you for joining us here on the podcast, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.